In West Virginia, coal could be closing shop, and that has some people worried.
Everybody was scared to death. Everybody's thinking, like, what are we going to do? Because there's nothing out here. How are they going to pay for everything? It was really a bad moment.
This is The Future of Coal, a production of the Allegheny Front. Today on our show, we'll learn about what Kentucky coal fields will look like in the decades to come.
You know, I just don't like the way it looks, and I think I have a right to that opinion. You know, I think it's ugly, but I have to live with it.
And we'll go out west, where a debate is heating up over coal's legacy there.
Are they going to be able to reclaim these aquifers in the creek? They say that they can, but it's all they're doing is talking theory, and here I'm living the practical thing.
That's The Future of Coal. Please stay tuned. This is The Future of Coal, a special production of the Allegheny Front in collaboration with West Virginia Public Broadcasting and Inside Energy. I'm Reed Frazier. What is the future of coal? Today, we'll take a deep dive on the topic by, among other things, looking at its past. For centuries, coal has provided light, heat, and energy to stay warm, cook food, and move us around the globe. We, of course, use it to make electricity. This recording equipment I'm using right now is probably 40% powered by the burning of coal. But coal is also the world's largest source of greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide. And we've known for decades that the buildup of these gases can hurt the planet. Listen to this news clip of a dire warning from a federal scientist from the first Earth Day, April 22, 1970.
Dr. J. Murray Mitchell said pollution and overpollution, unless checked, could so warm the Earth in 200 years as to create a greenhouse effect, melting the Arctic ice cap and flooding vast areas of the world.
President Obama has staked his reputation on doing something about climate change.
2014 was the planet's warmest year on record. 14 of the 15 hottest years on record have fallen in the first 15 years of this century. This is not a problem for another generation. Not anymore. This is a problem now.
But Obama's attempts to curb greenhouse gases could have a heavy impact in coal country. Last summer, a large group of protesters descended on the streets of Pittsburgh. Many wore camouflage T-shirts that bore the letters UMWA, United Mine Workers of America. These were coal miners from Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia. They'd come to protest the Obama administration's new rules for carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. Many were motivated by frustration and anxiety about the future, like Mark Sunyak of McClellantown, PA. It's a small coal mining community in the southwest corner of the state.
Well, our jobs, our securities for our families. I'm a recent retiree. My benefits may be in jeopardy. I worked 35 years in an underground coal mine to help supply this country with its energy requirements. I'm a fourth-generation coal miner and proud of it.
At a separate rally, Bill Barker, a surface miner from Boone County, West Virginia, had come to voice his displeasure. Barker says what's happening to the coal industry there poses something like an existential threat to his hometown.
Well, you know, it's probably not going to be an overnight thing, but it's going to slowly cut back on, the production of coal. And until we have something to diversify our economy a little better, it's going to turn our towns into ghost towns. There's just going to be nothing left to support us.
Have you seen that?
I've already been seeing it for the last few years. Businesses closing down. My neighbors packing up and moving south, Louisiana, South Carolina, seeing families torn apart, people lose their jobs, it just causes financial issues, and it's rough.
So what will happen to Bill Barker, Mark Sunyak, and other coal miners and the communities they live in? What does the future of coal look like? On today's show, we go to West Virginia, Kentucky, and Wyoming to look for answers. We'll look at coal's impact on land and people and what some possible ways forward could be. And we'll talk about the human toll that coal mining takes. That's coming up next on The Future of Coal, a special production of the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. Stay with us. Faced with competition from natural gas and increasing federal regulations, the coal industry is facing tough times. Layoffs and mine closings are becoming more and more common in parts of West Virginia and Kentucky. Reporter Catherine Moore went to find out what's next for those most heavily impacted by the coal industry's problems. We begin our coverage today there, in the coal fields of southern West Virginia.
At Chief Logan State Park in West Virginia, dozens of coal miners and their families are mulling around a cavernous ballroom. State officials called this meeting to help them figure out what to do next after the coal mine they worked in closed. Del Maynard is one of these miners. His primary emotion right now is shock.
I've been laid off three times in the last year. I'm not kidding. And it's not because I don't try to find a job, because I found three. Oh, it's awful. I'm telling you, this place would be a ghost town if they don't do something.
For others, like Steve Sigman, it's anger.
I think I'm more angry than anything because I don't think this has to happen. It's hurtful. Don't know really where to turn. I mean, I'm not an old man, but I'm not a young man either. And to start focusing on another career is it's a big adjustment in life.
Many are trying to bargain their way back to the way things used to be. If they could just get this one guy out of office, things would be great again.
Obama has absolutely stuck a dagger in the heart of coal.
And some, like Della and Bradford Hill, are just sad.
Laid off coal miner's wife, baby on the way, and a 2.5-year-old.
Yeah, right here at Christmas and the holidays.
Why are you, oh, I'm so sorry.
Kind of depressing.
It's an emotional thing, isn't
it? Yeah, very much, yeah.
All over Appalachia, people are in different stages of mourning this thing that's put dinner on the table and shaped the culture for so long. Some are even starting to talk about a transition, about Appalachia, past coal.
Whoa, that's an awesome tractor.
Shane Lucas trudges through the cold mud at a small mountain farm outside of Whitesburg, Kentucky.
This farm right here?
Uh-huh.
Pretty interesting.
Shane is pointing out a weathered barn on his property. It used to be a coal tipple, a structure where coal is loaded for transport.
Back in the 50s, my papa ran a coal tipple when I had to holler up here, and they all shut down.
Coal's long decline in Appalachia really began back in the 1950s, when machines started replacing miners.
So they went up in there and tore the coal tipple down, come back and built this barn out of it. So this barn was actually a coal tipple back in the 40s.
That's super fascinating to me.
It's hard to think of a better symbol of economic transition than this building we're standing in. The ruins of one industry repurposed to house another, agriculture. It's even more poignant because some people see small-scale farming as one promising economic sector for post-coal Appalachia.
My wife wants me to tear it down, but I hate to tear it down. But it is going to fall down shortly.
Yeah. Well, maybe you could use the wood for building something.
Yeah, I'm going to. I was thinking about building me a building or a chicken house or something out of it just to keep it.
For almost 20 years, Shane was a surface miner, running a production drill at the vast Cumberland River coal complex near his home. He loved his job. But then, 2 years ago, his life took a dramatic turn when he was laid off by Arch Coal. One day, they just shut the doors.
Drawed us into the room. We all started handing out the envelopes. And you open them up, and then there it is. Everybody was scared to death. Everybody's thinking, like, what are we going to do? Well, I mean, because there's nothing out here. Worried, you know, in debt. How are they going to pay for everything? It was really a bad moment.
But Shane had a backup plan. What started as a scheme to haul produce from Tennessee to pay for fishing trips has since blossomed into broccoli, turnips, and apple trees. It's Lucas Farm. By the time he lost his job, Shane was making some real money selling at his roadside stand. Not like in the mines, but just maybe enough.
fooling with this. I'm never broke. I've always got a dollar in my pocket. I might not can pay bills, but I've always got a dollar in my pocket. I could survive. You know, if I get laid off, keep from having to leave this part, maybe I could grow. You know, my wife works, so maybe we can make it instead of having to move off.
The region is in a really critical moment of economic transition. For me, it's a really pregnant moment of opportunity.
That's Ivy Brashear, an Eastern Kentuckian who works for Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, a nonprofit that's helping to chart a course for economic transition in the region. Entrepreneurship, energy efficiency, forestry, and local foods. It's a tough transition.
Not that it's easy to make that transition, it's really not. It's long, it's hard, and it's expensive, but there really is no other option for us if we are to survive as a region and as a people than to search for alternatives and to do something else.
For former miners like Shane, there's still a lot to work out. Growing food is an old tradition in eastern Kentucky, but selling crops is actually pretty new. Last year, when his boss called and offered Shane back his surface mining job, he said yes. But this time, he's not banking on the coal mine reopening. He's got a plan. Over the next 5 years, he'll be turning more ground under, planting a big berry patch, and looking to source produce year-round.
Would my life be easier just go back to coal mine and forget this? Or do I still try to juggle both and shoot for something that may not never happen and still have to go back to the coal mine? That's what's hard right now.
So what do you think? Do you have an answer? Or?
Shoot for it. Go for it. See what I can do. Grow. Maybe somebody else around here might say, hey, you can do it. Hey, I can do it. That's what I'm after. I'd love for it to work out that way.
Like many people in Appalachia, Shane is just trying to find his footing. He's thinking about what to build out of the wood of an old coal tipple. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Catherine Moore.
This is The Future of Coal from the Allegheny Front. What do you think? We love listener feedback. Talk to us on our Facebook page or tweet us at Allegheny Front. And while you're at it, use the hashtag Future of Coal. We'll be covering this issue much more in the months to come. But first, coming up next, mountaintop removal coal mining. It's had a severe impact on the land, and those impacts could linger.
It would take Mother Nature on her own to reforest these sites decades, if not centuries.
That's when our show continues. I'm Reed Frazier. You're listening to The Future of Coal from the Allegheny Front. This is The Future of Coal, a special production of the Allegheny Front in collaboration with West Virginia Public Broadcasting and Inside Energy. I'm Reed Frazier. Today, we're looking at the future for coal and coal country, and that includes the land where the coal is mined. In central Appalachia, coal is in a long decline. Even though mining jobs are disappearing there, the stains that coal mining has left on the landscape are not. About 1 million acres of strip mine land, an area the size of Rhode Island, are now deforested. I went to eastern Kentucky to see what will happen to the land when the coal is gone. Patrick Angel is a forester with the U.S. Office of Surface Mining. He's at the top of a ridge in eastern Kentucky looking over a sea of brown grass.
You can see it goes on and on and on for many, many acres.
This flattened hilltop is what's left over from mountaintop removal. This is the controversial form of surface mining where the top of a mountain is blown up and shoved into a valley to access a coal seam below. Many hills in eastern Kentucky now look exactly like this one.
Looking across this landscape, you know, if you didn't know where you were, you'd think that you were standing in, a prairie land in South Dakota. Right. Or Wyoming, and because it's all grass.
The grasses growing on this ridge have roots so thick they choke out other plants, including trees. So the native forests of eastern Kentucky cannot grow back here.
Basically, Mother Nature is stuck in a place where she cannot return the forests on her own.
This situation is the result of a law that passed nearly 40 years ago to improve former mine lands. The Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act was passed in 1977 to protect coal country communities. Back then, it was fairly common for landslides to start at abandoned coal mines and just keep going into people's houses.
As the occupants were running out the front door. We wanted to stop that so bad.
And they did stop it. How? With bulldozers and grass seed.
The way we accomplished it was by telling mine operators to pack it in, compact it, get it tight, and sculpture it like a golf course.
So this is what Angel and his agency did for 20 years or so. It did stop the landslides, but there was a problem that nagged Angel. The trees wouldn't grow back.
And then the scientists came to us.
These scientists were studying how to put forests back on former surface mines, and they'd figured out a way to do it. Angel takes me to a field that looks like it's been dug up by a giant rototiller. His partner, Mike French, of the nonprofit Green Forests Work, cuts into dirt and rock with a digging bar. Their group is planting trees here now.
It would take Mother Nature on her own to reforest these sites decades, if not centuries.
It costs about $1,000 an acre to reforest these sites, but doing nothing comes with its own costs, too. New forests can clean up one of coal's worst environmental legacies, polluted streams. Chris Barton is standing over one of them. Barton studies coal mining's impact on water quality at the University of Kentucky.
What you see what we have here is this was the original stream channel. And you can see the big, large boulders there.
The boulders he's pointing to came from a mountaintop removal site above the valley we're standing in. They were part of the rock, soil, and gravel covering over a coal seam and were pushed over the hillside to get at the coal beneath them.
On this particular one, there's about 200 feet of material on top of what was the original stream bed.
That material has turned the stream a bright reddish orange. That color is from iron that was once lodged inside the mountain.
But when you mine them, you're taking a rock like the one we see over here and blasting that into a zillion pieces, and then suddenly it becomes at a size where it can dissolve.
Barton thinks if trees were to grow on top, that would prevent a lot of the runoff that's causing this pollution. And there are signs this can happen.
Okay, then. Well, we'll be in these two cells here for
Paul Rothman is with the Kentucky's Department of Natural Resources. On a vast surface mine in eastern Kentucky, he walks through a gate where a small but healthy forest is taking root.
And what you see is there are seven different species that I'll introduce you to out here. You got white ash, white oak, yellow poplar, total
Rothman
poplar,
helped plant these trees poplar, almost 20 years ago. Walnut. Today, windblown orchids, sweetbriars, and birches are sprouting from the forest floor.
The stereotype or the thought is that once these areas are mined and reclaimed, you can never grow forests back on them. And what we're trying to do is show people that's not quite accurate.
Up a tiny meandering mountain road in Letcher County, Kentucky, a coal company is finishing up a strip mining job. Huge machines move dirt and rock around a large open pit. Just down the hill from the mine are John and Loretta Henriksen, Loretta Henriksen grew up on this mountain. She's never liked strip mining.
But, you know, I'm supporting the miners and I'm supporting jobs, but, you know, I just don't like the way it looks. And I think I have a right to that opinion. You know, I think it's ugly, but I have to live with it.
She used to argue about it with her brother, who's a coal miner. But then came one conversation.
He said to me, he said, "You don't know what it's like." He said, "You got a husband that's got a good job and can feed you." And he said, "We don't. You know, if our job is over, what do we do?"
Her husband, John, was a school teacher. He had a secure job with benefits. Her brother didn't have that.
And he said, if you had to rely on a miner to make a living, you know, if your husband was a miner and he lost his job and you had no way to pay your bills or to eat, he said, I believe you'd change your mind on how you feel about strip mining. I mean, we used to argue, get in hot discussions about it. So then finally I realized when he said that, it just like pricked my heart. So I said, I'm not going to talk about being against strip mine ever again.
At some point, maybe soon, the mine at the top of the hill will go quiet. But even if no coal ever comes off the top of the mountain again, it'll bear the marks of mining for years to come. Loretta Henriksen has come to accept it. And when asked, had she ever thought of moving, she says she would never want to leave the place she's from. You've just heard about the federal law designed to protect coal mining communities. That law passed in 1977, but many of Appalachia's coal mines were dug before the law was passed, which means there are thousands of problem mines throughout the region that are not subject to that law's protections. These are called pre-law mines, and they come with a bevy of problems. They fill up with water and cause landslides. They catch fire. To get a sense of these problems up close, I got a tour with some veteran mine inspectors whose job is to clean up these decades-old mine problems.
Well, you just want to do that, go Ed Noble first then, Wally?
My driver for the day is Jim Holliday. Holliday is a bluegrass fan, and he wears a handlebar mustache. Today, he's in his Federal Office of Surface Mines uniform. He used to work on strip mines, but for decades, he's been an inspector. We're driving along Highway 80 in Perry County, in the heart of eastern Kentucky coal country. We turn off the road into a hollow.
They mined everything they could get in these hollows.
We get out of the SUV and walk toward a house that hugs a steep hillside. The driveway we park on is brand new. Holliday's partner for the day is Wally Barger.
Natural ground was here this close to the house, and it sloped down the mountain.
Barger is a mine inspector with the Kentucky Department of Natural Resources. He's standing next to a house with gray siding. We're here to look at one of the most common issues posed by these old mines.
Too much groundwater from the coal mines, from the mining back in the 1940s and 50s, and there's like three coal seams here, the Hazard 5, the Hazard 7, and the Hazard 8, and they all had water in them, in the voids that left by the mining.
And that water caused the hillside we're standing on to move. That pushed the ground from underneath a house that we're standing next to. The house's owner comes out to greet us.
The house started falling. The basement, part of it dropped down under it.
Ed Noble grew up nearby. He remembers watching miners digging coal out of the hillside above us when he was a kid. He's owned this house for 20 years. In late 2013, the house began breaking apart.
It just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Water come out under the floor, and it was slipping. The whole foundation was falling out under it. It just dropped it down about 4 foot.
The state came in and dug straight down to bedrock. It reinforced the foundation and saved Ed Noble's house.
Ah, buddy, it's scary, son. It is scary.
Barger says there was a moment in the project when he thought the house would have to be demolished.
Yes, I thought we had lost it, and you know, we were able to get it crealed back up and get it stabilized. So we spent $500,000 or so to save this house.
The state of Kentucky got that money from a special tax on coal that goes specifically to abandoned mines built before 1977. But that source of funding might not last forever. For starters, there's less coal being mined these days, so there's less money in the fund. And in 2021, unless Congress renews it, the money is scheduled to run out.
We'll never run out of reclamation jobs, but we will run out of money because our money's going to start dwindling, and then in 2021 it goes to a halt because we don't have any future funds, any tax against the coal company or fees, however you want to say it. It's not going to be there anymore.
We get back in Holiday's SUV, and we make our way to the top of a hill. It's steep and covered with waste coal. Basically, it looks like a huge pile of charcoal was dumped on the hillside. Jim Holiday leads me to a part of the hillside where blue smoke is wafting off the ground.
When you see steam and smoke, that doesn't mean the only place that it's burning, that it is burning. And stuff can be burning underneath. It can be burned out underneath. And you'll step, be crusted over. You can step on it. So I wouldn't venture around too much on it.
This is a coal refuse fire. The state of Kentucky is trying to put the fire out. Basically, all the old coal on the ground is burning. There is a smell to this fire, and it's awful.
Just a stench. That smell is so...
Oh, we were just talking. That smells a whole lot better than it was this summer. I don't know what the difference is. It was something in...
It was worse.
Oh, God.
The mine here was built in the 1920s. The coal left on the hillside is waste coal. Basically, it wasn't pure enough to sell at the time that it was mined. So miners just left it on the ground.
You will find rocks and burning materials in there at 350, 400 degrees. You have to kind of isolate them and mix them in with some dirt and other materials and haul it somewhere that you can mix with more dirt. We use water to cool it down and try to control it enough that the operators can work safely.
So many hillsides in eastern Kentucky are like this one, covered by pieces of coal left by miners long gone, that these fires will just keep igniting for years to come. Sometimes it's forest fires that start them, and they can burn for years.
And hopefully, in 30 more years from now, they're still putting them out. If the funds are there.
They'll still be burning in 30 years, you think?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a lot of years. There's too many of them. Too many of these old refuse piles around.
Holiday and Barger get back in the truck. They say they'll keep coming back to do this work, policing landslides, putting out fires, as long as the money keeps coming in to pay for it. The writer Silas House grew up in the hills of eastern Kentucky. Through his novels and other writing, he's described life in coal country through rich, complex characters steeped in history and tradition. He's not only an observer, he's also an activist in the fight against mountaintop removal coal mining. I spoke with him about coal and its impact on the place he grew up. Here's that conversation.
Well, I grew up in a coal mining family in a coal mining community. Most all the men that in my family worked in the mines in some capacity. My father didn't, and I didn't, but most everybody else did. And, you know, you just grow up, it's a culture unto itself, and it's something that you're very proud to be a part of. We knew that we were supplying energy to the United States, to the world. We knew that it was hard work, and it took, you know, tough people to do it. But we were also really aware of the environmental impact it had on our community. When I was about 11, I guess, a huge strip mine moved in across the road from our house, and for the next 2 years that sort of took over our lives, you know. We breathed the dust, we heard the blast, we just... It changed that community forever, and that had a real, I don't know, lasting impression on me. It made me aware of how double-edged that sword was, you know, of growing up, being really proud of being from that coal mining legacy. My grandfather lost his leg in the coal mines and recuperated 6 months and went right back in. He counted his colleagues in the mines as his brothers, you know, and so it's a really complex thing, a really love-hate relationship. Coal brought my family up out of deep poverty, but at the same time, my family and people in my community and my place have really paid the price.
So I wanted to ask you about your own entry into activism. When did you become an activist against mountaintop removal? And I wanted you to talk about why.
Even when I was a little boy, when the big strip mine first moved in, I was constantly wanting to challenge them. And, you know, I wanted my parents to complain more about it to the county and to the state. And I just saw how much damage it was doing to our road and to our water. It completely changed the landscape. When about this time, at a separate mine that abutted my father's family's graveyard, the coal company was mining so close to the graveyard that they pushed my great aunt's grave over the mountain and into the creek below it. And I remember how upset my father was about that. So I think the seeds were sown there for me, and I was always very conscious of all that happening, and it was something you couldn't talk about in a complex way, you know, because the economy came first. And so in 2005, Wendell Berry contacted me and 14 other Kentucky writers. By that time, I had two novels out. And, you know, when Wendell Berry calls you and asks you to do something, you do it. And Wendell said, I want you to go on a tour with me of Eastern Kentucky, and we're going to look at mountaintop removal sites. And I knew all about strip mining. I knew about deep mining, and I felt like I knew the coal industry pretty well, but I really, even living amongst it, didn't understand mountaintop removal and how different that was and how devastating it was. The most profound thing, though, was that we had a town meeting where we invited anybody who wanted to come talk about their experiences with mountaintop removal, with coal mining. And people, just dozens and dozens of people came, and we were there 3 or 4 hours sitting there just hearing people tell their experiences. And almost every one of them would end their testimony by saying, nobody will listen to us. Please tell our story. And please get our story out there. And all of us sitting there felt like we had been handed this responsibility and that we had to do something.
We'll have more of that interview coming up. And later in the show, coal's center of gravity has begun a long move to the west. But there are even worries out there about what kind of future coal miners will have.
The kids that I'm seeing come to work for the mines now, I tell them, are you really sure this is what you want to do? Because this job might not be here.
That's when our show continues. This is The Future of Coal, a special production of the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. Please stay with us. Welcome back to The Future of Coal from the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. We come back to my discussion now with Silas House. He's a writer and activist from Eastern Kentucky. He's written about mountaintop removal mining in places like the New York Times and Sierra Magazine. Here's more of our conversation. What's the reaction been like in Eastern Kentucky to some of your writing and some of your activism?
Well, people tend to have really strong reactions one way or the other. You know, I mean, people write to me and thank me for speaking out and for being vocal about it. And then some people, you know, tell me that I'm a traitor to my own place, to my own people. That's a really hurtful thing, you know, to hear, because I care so deeply about the place and the people. I have a sticker on my back window that says I'm a friend of miners and mountains. And so, you know, every time I talk about coal and the devastating aspects of coal, I always want to talk about my deep respect for the coal miners, for the people who do the really hard work. When I'm talking about being against coal, I'm talking about being against these huge corporations that, you know, don't think about balance. They don't think about the communities that they're harming. And for the most part, they don't think about their miners, their employees. You know, it's all a numbers game. And so I always try to get at that complexity.
In your writings, you've called mountaintop removal not just an environmental issue, but a human issue as well. I was just wondering if you could explain what you mean by that.
As an Appalachian, you're told all of your life that you're worthless, that you are throwaway people, that you don't really matter. You see Appalachians on TV, and they're always portrayed as stupid, lazy, small-minded, illiterate. You know, I mean, it's always a negative portrayal. And you're told that your whole life, and no matter the pride that your family and your community instills in you, some little part of you believes that. You know, lots of Appalachians will say, I had to learn how to talk right. I've got a bad accent. I got rid of that. You know, there's this connotation that to be Appalachian, to have the markers of an Appalachian, is bad, and you have to get rid of that. That's why, obviously, I kept my accent, but I never could get rid of it and didn't want to. But I think something like mountaintop removal, the companies use that. They feed into that, and it's very cultural. They know that one of the things that we have always had to be proud of is coal mining. And so anybody who questions that in any way is attacked. You know, they're told they're a traitor, they're not a patriot, et cetera, et cetera. And all those things. Most of the people I know who've been active in the fight against mountaintop removal have had death threats. And, you know, I've had threatening letters sent to me about my children, et cetera, et cetera.
So your children were threatened, or somebody mentioned your children in a threatening letter?
Yes, I mean, it was written in a vague way, you know, a subtle way, but it was definitely there. One of those, you know, I know where you live, I see your kids playing out in the yard, was pretty much what it said. I mean.
And what was your reaction to that?
Well, my initial reaction was to not speak out again, you know, and then after a night of thinking about it, I thought, well, this is one reason I have to keep speaking out about it. I think that it made me realize, really, I was speaking out because of my children more than anything else, because I wanted them to have clean water. I wanted them to be able to, you know, be from a place they could be proud of, that they could bring people to, and it not be utter ruin. If anything, you know, it solidified my passion for the issue. It's never gone out of my mind. I've never stopped worrying about it. I was more protective of my children and reported it and all that. But, you know, you just, you choose if you're going to use it for the negative or the positive in those instances. And I think it made me more forceful, and it rallied a lot of people.
That's novelist, activist, Kentuckian, and dad, Silas House. We have a longer version of that interview on our website, AlleghenyFront.com. www.thefutureofcoal.org. This is The Future of Coal. I'm Reed Frazier. Now, westward. More than two decades ago, Kentucky lost its place as the nation's number one coal-producing state. The number one honor now falls to Wyoming. Why did Wyoming become such a big coal producer? In a word, regulation. And now a series of new regulations are changing the industry even more. Lee Patterson from Inside Energy has more.
It's going to tell me to add paper.
Robert Henning is an historian at a small county museum in northeastern Wyoming. He's photocopying old newspaper clippings for me.
This is from the Gillette News Record, the local paper.
With headlines like Riches from the Ground and...
I believe a special section called the Powder River Energy Story. It's from June 1975.
The 1970s marked an important era for Wyoming coal, basically its birthday. It all started with the first ever federal law to tackle air pollution, the Clean Air Act of 1970, and the amendments that followed. In its wake, demand for Wyoming's low sulfur coal skyrocketed, and jobs did too. In 1970, Wyoming employed just 621 coal miners. A decade later, more than 6,000.
It's called Campbell County Coal, one environmentalist.
As we look through the old news clippings, today, coal is still the number one source of American electricity. But Robert Henning is concerned.
Who knows what is in the future of the energy industry? So to have this document and record about what happened here in Gillette is very important.
That uncertainty about the future is a feeling shared in coal-producing states all across the country these days, especially with a new set of regulations called the Clean Power Plan. The Environmental Protection Agency's proposal aims to cut carbon emissions from existing power plants. And although the rule won't be finalized until this summer, coal country lawmakers are fighting back. Here's Wyoming Governor Matt Mead.
In the coming years, we don't need to let up. We need to double down. We must assure coal's continuity.
This fear, this fight, is strongly tied to the fact that many coal-fired power plants are already partially or fully shutting down. At least five have closed already this year, and it's not just because of the Clean Power Plan. Even before that, factors like new mercury regulations on power plant emissions have been mixing with market forces like cheaper natural gas and the rising cost of mining coal. It's all sowing anxiety in homes like this one.
Come on in, ladies.
Hey.
This is a house of many noises.
Hey, everyone.
Coal miner Beverly Bauman and her husband, Rick Swanson, live in Rosette, a town in Wyoming's remote, coal-rich Powder River Basin. In the early 70s, Swanson helped build a mine in that basin called Black Thunder.
It was the biggest construction project I ever worked on. And I was just a little old tiny piece of it, you know.
It's now the largest coal mine in the United States. Beverly worked in the industry as well, and that's where she met Rick.
Fact is, when we finally got married, people go, "You did? I thought you guys were going to stay shacked up forever."
Over the years, the industry has been good for them and their large extended family, steady work and fair pay. Nationally, coal production and employment is down, but Wyoming, so far, hasn't really suffered. Still, what do they see for the future of coal?
Rick and I came here and we ended up in the sweet part of life. But the kids that I'm seeing come to work for the mines now, I tell them, "Are you really sure this is what you want to do? Because this job might not be here."
None of Beverly and Rick's children went into mining, but their nephew, Philip Karstens, did. As he plays a board game with his son, Philip explains that he moved to Wyoming from California 8 months ago for a coal mining job that he loves. But his son may not follow in his footsteps.
The way things are, probably won't be around that long.
These worries are real. And although the substantial regulatory threats to the industry are being challenged in court, if history is any judge, they are likely to eventually prevail in some form. I'm Lee Patterson.
Lee Patterson reports for Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. we just heard why the American West is now coal's new home base. And though production has dipped slightly in Wyoming, the state still produces 40% of the nation's coal, far more than any other state. Reporter Clay Scott went to America's current coal capital and found the industry's imprint on the West runs deep.
Traveling south of Gillette, Wyoming, through an arid and austere country once home to herds of bison, you pass coal mine after coal mine for 70 uninterrupted miles, carving deep troughs into the prairie. Seen from a distance, the immensity of the mining activity is striking. But descend into one of these open pit mines for the first time, and it's hard not to be overwhelmed by the sheer scale of things. Blasting teams set explosive charges to loosen the steep sides of what look like gigantic sunken amphitheaters. Colossal digging machines called coal shovels load hundreds of tons at a time into haul trucks three stories high. Huge bulldozers rip away layers of dirt to get at rich coal seams, and clouds of brown and black dust darken the air. Endless trains of railroad cars snake through the mine to be piled high with coal. The scene is at once intimidating, surreal, and impressively efficient. At the Eagle Butte mine near Gillette, J.D. Deechy showed me the coal shovel he's operated for Alpha Coal for a decade, 7 days on, 7 days off. On a frigid day, my hands stick to the metal rungs as we climb into the $50 million machine.
You drive your truck to the dirt shovel, get a load of dirt, take it to the dump, come back and do it again and again and again and again for 12 and a half hours, minus your half hour lunch break, but it is very, very repetitious.
It is repetitious work, often dangerous, and the hours are long, but coal is an important part of the economy of this sparsely populated state, and the 7,000 or so jobs it provides are highly sought after. Miners like Carrie C., who's worked in coal for 30 years, have raised their families with their earnings, but it's more than just a paycheck.
Because we are willing to go out and run that equipment and mine the coal and bring it out of the earth, and we work holidays 24/7 through snow, through rain, through all kinds of weather, then everybody else has the luxuries of electricity and running water.
The coal that's mined each year in the Powder River Basin, 400 million tons of it, supplies power to millions of people. It's lower in polluting sulfur than eastern coal and closer to the surface. But while you might not have to blow the tops off mountains to get at the seams, coal mining here has still impacted the land and the people who depend on it in profound and far-reaching ways.
From our perspective in here, it really seems that most of the time we're the only ones that don't have the ranch for sale and hoping to sell it to a coal company.
That's L.J. Turner. His family has ranched in the southern end of the Powder River Basin since 1916.
This is home. It's been home for all of our lives, and it's going to continue to be so.
We're standing on a low ridge at the eastern edge of LJ's ranch, looking out at the North Antelope Rochelle coal mine. The mine sprawls for miles over pastures where cattle once grazed. Historically, ranchers in this area have depended on public grazing leases to make a living, but those leases are superseded by mineral development, and the Turner family has lost thousands of acres to mining. This is, or it was, a landscape of rolling grassland punctuated by rugged breaks where mule deer took shelter. But the contours of the land have been altered to get at the coal. By law, the coal companies are bound to reclaim the land when they finished mining it.
The coal miners over here, whenever they first moved in and started taking our pastures, they said, oh, you just wait until we reclaim this land. It's going to be so good, you won't believe how good it's going to be. And that's been 30 years ago, maybe. And our cows have never had a mouthful of reclaimed grass in those 30 years.
Of even greater concern, says LJ, is the steady drying up of local water sources, which he attributes to coal mining.
Are they going to be able to reclaim these aquifers in the creek? Because I don't think they can. They say that they can, but it's all they're doing is talking theory, and here I'm living the practical thing.
In western Montana, at his home along the Bitterroot River, I met Bill Ritchie. He's someone who's given a lot of thought to the impacts of western coal mining on water. Over more than 20 years, he managed several mines in the Powder River Basin.
There are problems. There are water problems. There are things that are hard to replace and hard to reclaim. The real complex stuff was the environmental issues. Tracking the water, trying to dewater, trying not to pollute streams. Really took a lot of work, a lot of effort, and a lot of money.
When Bill first started working in coal, he says, Western mines were being applauded for producing a product that was much cleaner than Eastern coal. But toward the end of his career, he told me, he started to re-examine some of his assumptions about coal mining.
We didn't understand the impact on the atmosphere and the greenhouse gases. We didn't understand mercury as well, or the problems it creates in people's health, just burning it. We worked on clean coal projects from the time I was first starting in the coal business, and they still are working on them. There is no such thing currently as clean coal. The net result is it's still polluting the atmosphere.
All coal mines, says Bill Ritchie, including the ones he managed, begin by taking the coal that's closest to the surface and easiest and cheapest to get at. As the mine goes longer in its life, the coal will be deeper and thinner seamed and more costly to recover.
Hopefully someday they will figure out a technology on a commercial scale that can burn coal cleanly. But what a pity if we've mined all the coal and burned it and polluted the hell out of everything. Then when it's time, when we have the ability to burn it well, we don't have the resource.
Bill Ritchie says the type of clean coal technology he's talking about is not likely to be perfected anytime soon. In the meantime, coal, that powerful and dirty and much debated black rock, is certain to remain a feature of the economy and landscape of the West for many years to come. In Gillette, Wyoming, I'm Clay Scott.
You've been listening to The Future of Coal, a special presentation from the Allegheny Front, in collaboration with West Virginia Public Broadcasting and Inside Energy. Like the Allegheny Front on Facebook so you can see more of our stories. Follow us on Twitter at Allegheny Front. And you can also follow our partners at WV Public and at Inside Energy. If you've ever missed an Allegheny Front story, we have them all online, I promise, on AlleghenyFront.org. And on iTunes. Reports from today's show were supported by High Plains News. Special thanks to Ingrid Lobet and the people at Apple Shop, WMMT, and WUKY. I'm Reed Frazier. Kathy Naur is the Allegheny Front's executive producer. Kathy Zhao is our intern. Come back next week for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.